I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel. They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Look, like anybody else, Noel, Matt, Paul, and Doc Holliday and I have been watching the news here in the United States, and we know the same old cycle has come round once again in states across the nation in recent years. Various groups are calling to ban certain books. You guys have obviously, we've all heard about this.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely a political thing happening right now.
It sure is. Very divisive. Seems to be a bit of a tool to further certain political ideologies and rhetoric. And honestly, it just seems kind of like an alarmist sort of propaganda kind of move.
Yeah. And you raise an interesting point, because there is currently no book that everyone in the U.S. agrees should be banned. People have these divisive opinions, and we could argue here that at the heart of the issue, there's a dueling set of conspiracies. We're going to talk about these perspectives. We'll tackle one of the biggest questions. Should any knowledge be banned? Here are the facts.
This is a question we've tackled a lot of times when it comes to human experimentation, right? Like, should the knowledge gained from that kind of brutality actually be shared and known, or should it just go away, right? And it's the same deal, I guess, we're tackling here. And when we're talking about knowledge, we're talking about, right, active knowledge that you could get, that you could gain from reading a book, like to, you know, show you how to do something, or even a novel, something that's fictional that could potentially create some dangerous ideas within the reader.
They could be weaponized, right? Yeah, and it's weird because, oh, classic human, the idea of banning books is as old as the technology of books themselves. It's honestly older, right? Everybody knows knowledge is a kind of power, so it's no surprise that over the span of human history, certain forces, whether they're states or kingdoms or religions, they sought to control knowledge. And the easiest way to control knowledge, of course, is to control education. Like old Dirty Bastard said, Wu-Tang is for the children.
It's true. And I love the idea, by the way, Ben, of thinking of books as technology, something that we really take for granted, but it's probably the most basic and powerful of technology.
Right? It's
it's one of the greatest hits. You know, we talk about reading often on this show in terms of just the brilliance of it. It's kind of spooky to be able to read. It's sort of time travel. It's sort of necromancy. You're communicating in some way with the dead. And that's inspiring. That's creepy. That's many other things. The modern debate over banning books. What's interesting is it's usually framed as a protective measure for the public in the current day. But back in the day, other power structures would say we need to protect the knowledge of the elite from the unwashed masses, right? And you see it in U.S. history as well, when enslaved people were punished for the crime of literacy, just for being able to read. I don't know. It's a weird switch, I guess, the rationale. But this stuff has been going on for a long, long time. We got together and we looked up the first thing considered to be a book ever. And generally, right now, the first thing considered to be a quote-unquote book is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is kind of old.
Yeah, not to be confused with the Epic of Gargamel, a.k.a. the Smurfs.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to go there.
And that goes back to 2100 BCE. It was banned in, I think it was like the year after it came out, right? No, I'm just joking. It was not banned.
It wasn't, but it was, you know, the history of books is like the history of other old technology. It's almost impossible to figure out who decided to make the wheel, or who said, hey, we can use this fire thing for all sorts of stuff, right?
Yeah. Y'all wait until you hear our episode on banned scrolls. And then we've got a third part that's banned tablets. Those are going to be doozies.
And then we've got a fourth part that is banned from us. Yeah.
Yeah. And banned cave paintings.
Whole caves are banned completely from history. I mean, we do know that this practice of restricting information is so old that it is impossible to name the very first banned book or scroll or cave painting or what have you in history. But these debates, these controversies did lead to widespread violence. You think stuff is bad on Twitter now, folks? Entire libraries were set aflame. Of course, most popular being the Library of Alexandria, but collections were destroyed or burned in China, the Middle East, North Africa, Europe, you name it. And this was interesting. I didn't know this one. The first book banning in what we call the modern day U.S. predates the concept of the United States.
Oh, snap. Yeah, it goes back to Salem witch trial era. It goes back even further to 1637. My goodness. Wait, was there a power structure that wanted to control thought and knowledge at the time or something?
No. Some sort of elitist organization seeking to control hearts and minds and set the tone of civilization?
Oh, geez, guys, I don't know. That sounds a bit puritanical.
Landed.
It does indeed.
this book is by a writer, an author named Thomas Morton. And you may have heard of in the past. I know he's actually pretty popular for his, let's say, different takes on some major religions within the early budding, let's say, United States post Church of England, not post Church of England. Let's say breakaway from Church of England, breakaway so far that they went all the way across an ocean.
Yeah. His book, New English Canaan, was banned by the Puritan government of the area in modern-day Massachusetts, Quincy, Massachusetts, because they didn't like his take on Puritan customs and power structures. He was opposing the official narrative, which is, of course, the ideology that pushed them across the Atlantic in the first place. Everyone is wrong. We are correct. We are not taking questions at this time.
I love that.
I mean, that's the vibe, right?
Yeah. Well, I was trying to find a copy of it, and it looks like you may be able to find excerpts, or maybe like I couldn't find a physical copy of it anywhere. Obviously, it was banned in the mid 1600s, so probably difficult to come by, right? But I do wonder if at a place like, I don't know, somewhere out in Massachusetts, there's an old library that has one in the basement, you know, like stored away.
Harvard?
Yeah. One of those towns, I can't remember the name of the town right now.
Peabody?
Maybe. The place that is actually where Salem and where the witch trials occurred, but it's like right outside of what is called Salem today. But I know there's an old library there, and they had some incredible books from the 1600s. I wonder if they've got one.
Well, this whole Puritan model kind of makes me think, I mean, I know this is maybe outside the scope of today's conversation, but if there were like grimoires, for example, or like books that were known, I mean, we have all this lore and, you know, pop culture stuff around hidden books, like the, you know, the Necronomicon being locked away because it unleashes, you know, untold evil upon the world. I think that's an interesting metaphor, you know, for what knowledge can do, for what information can do with or without black magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this practice of banning books, it was much easier back in those days. To your point, Matt, there were no PDFs, you know, there was no paste bin, etc. So you could literally go to whomever was writing the book by hand, or to, you know, the one guy in a 100-mile area who owned a printing press, and smack him around, Soprano style, and say, not this book, okay? Not this book. You keep to the version of the Bible that we greenlit. They wouldn't say greenlit because they didn't have traffic lights, but you know what we mean. Let's fast forward to the modern day, and maybe we talk about the conspiracies that are driving the argument here about banning books. Like, I think one of the first things we should say is proponents of banning books in public libraries, they don't see themselves as villains. They're not saying, ha ha, we'll keep people from learning algebra or whatever.
I mean, I guess we've talked about, you know, how formative libraries were for us growing up. And I think maybe that was a different time, because I just remember having access to all kinds of inappropriate material at my local library. You know, when my parents finally drew the line at the electric Kool-Aid acid test by Ken Kesey, which I remember when they saw, they're like, nope, you can't read that. But they didn't care that I read Dean Koontz and Stephen King and all this like murder, you know, psychotic, you know, devil worship book. But a little bit of counterculture hippiedom, you know, about LSD was a bridge too far.
Yeah. Parents as a government, right? That's part of it. The idea that the parents as the governing structure of the home should be able to decree what is and is not appropriate. And I'm with you there, Noel. I remember being baffled that I could read Stephen King's It at mm-hmm. such a young age with no problems, but then also be able to read things like Beyond a Pale Horse or Behold a Pale Horse, whatever that work was.
And to your point about parents as government, now you've got, you know, things called parental locks, you know, on your Netflix accounts or whatever. So it's a whole lot easier to enforce that kind of stuff because, frankly, kids aren't reading books anymore. Everything's digital, you know? And so when you have the keys to that digital kingdom, you kind of are, you know, the arbiter of information.
That's really interesting, guys. I'm thinking about public speeches that have been made in the past that could also, you know, fit into this little test that we're talking about here. Are there dangerous public speeches where, like, sure, we should, like, those should somehow be banned in the same way? I'm thinking about, like, H-Rap Brown or, you know, some of the, like, other leaders of SNCC or some of these other, like, groups that could have been considered super dangerous at the time.
Mm, or Leonard Peltier, right, with AIM or something like that.
I guess I typically associate speeches with inciting an action in the moment, you know, like people say that, you know, the speech that Donald Trump made on January 6th literally led to the insurrection, but separated from that event, that might not have as much of an impact. But to your point, if people are really out there spewing ideology, you know, and they're really laying things out there that could be harnessed, you know, I could see that, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And as we record today, multiple state-level governments have enacted bans on school libraries, as well as public libraries, meaning that with the surface rationale being we must protect the children, the most vulnerable part of the population, they are also removing access to information from adults who may not have kids, who may not interact with anyone under 30. You know what I mean? Like we don't know. They don't see themselves, though, as keeping information from an unworthy public. The conspiracy that you will see is this idea arguing that we are fighting back against some sort of insidious, often phrased as liberal, agenda. And they feel there is a conspiracy afoot to twist the minds of children through propaganda. And from their point of view, certain books might push kids toward unhealthy viewpoints, decisions, or behaviors. Because kids are impressionable. That part is true. That last part is true.
Yeah. And I'm just unaware of this, guys. I'm unaware of any books that were banned within the U.S. for promoting communism, like during the Cold War times. I'm sure there's something, but like I'm imagining that would be something, right? This communist agenda that we have to fight back against.
You sure think that, given the all of the hearings and, you know, the people who are blacklisted and all of that in Hollywood, you know, for espousing communist viewpoints or being a member or whatever, you would think that there would have been more kind of like comics code kind of stuff where things were literally like taken out of circulation or like, you know, pulled. I don't have an answer to that. That's a very interesting thing to think about, though.
Yeah, it's weird because, so there's the Comstock Law, or the Federal Anti-Obscenity Act, that banned a lot of stuff like the Canterbury Tales or the Decameron. But in terms of being banned for propagating communist ideology, maybe the answer is something like you would. Okay, this is absolutely true. This is a true conspiracy. The federal government, especially before the advent of the internet, secretly did track people's library records. So maybe it's a situation where if you are reading certain books or checking out, you know, too much Karl Marx from your local library, you might get flagged as a person of interest. You know what I mean?
And you might never know it. It just means that you're on somebody's radar. And then if you ever were to do something sus, then they've got, you know, info on you, or they're keeping tabs to some degree. I guess the reason, maybe, Matt, for the whole, like, why haven't they banned certain books or, you know, about communist propaganda, is America really doesn't like to ban books because it's sort of part of the Constitution that we can have freedom of speech. And what, you know, is the pinnacle of freedom of speech of not being able to write whatever you want in a book without fear of like censorship? Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail it. I just like, I think the idea of banning books in America is certainly, it's not something that we take lightly. You know what I mean? It's not like it happens all the time, you know?
Well, we've certainly tried it a lot of times, again, and in the same context, right? Specifically, as you're saying, in public schools, public libraries.
Yeah. And the concerns that get the most airtime today are tending to revolve around things like gender or racial identity, or they're tending to revolve around how people would like history depicted or recounted. You know what I mean? And this is very potent, powerful stuff. I mean, okay, on the other side of the equation, the groups that fight against banning books, they also don't see themselves as villains. They see themselves as protectors. They think their perspective is we are protecting history from being rewritten. We are protecting the rights of vulnerable populations, and we're allowing them to be addressed, to be acknowledged, and to be represented in literature. And, you know, honestly, look, while a lot of the banning is coming from more conservative actors in the political sphere, the political left has moved to ban books as well, most often for objectionable phrasing, for using racial epithets, for perpetuating just bonkers stereotypes and stuff like that. There's an example, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, written by an author named Sherman Alexie. There were what you could call politically left movements to ban that book from some schools because there were concerns about offensive, racially charged language. And you can read a lot about this book because it generated a lot of controversy. Multiple different municipalities have tried to pull this book from the shelves.
Yeah, like same with like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, you know, some of the debates around that because of its, you know, problematic language and use of racial slurs. But also it is a work of fiction that was written in a specific time or in a certain time period. So it starts to be a little bit more about like, are we censoring history? Like, are we editing history? And then, you know, it's like a lot of this movement to change the language in Roald Dahl books, I find a little bit odd, you know? I mean, I just think when you start revising things to that degree, you start George Lucasing everything, you know, and sanitizing it, you don't have any history left. I mean, I think we can learn from problematic things in history, but to completely erase it seems really short-sighted to me.
Are you guys aware of the Captain Underpants graphic novel series?
Yes. Yes.
Ben, are you actually? If you don't have a kid, you may not know.
You see it on
that's just how. Yeah, no, I'm aware of it. I haven't read it, okay. But I know about it.
I didn't know that there were attempts to ban that series because the characters are, quote, disrespectful to authority figures, which is really interesting. If we're talking about control and then having the, you know, books in a school or promoted by the school by having them made available. And just to undermine your staff. I mean, that's a really interesting concept to me.
Too much fight the power. They don't want that kind of superhero. What they want a Batman. They want an authoritarian billionaire as a protagonist.
But it's an inside job because I think in that story, if I'm not wrong, the superhero Captain Underpants is actually one of the main administrators of the school. So the kind of, I don't know, the figure that's looked up to is a like an anti-hero version of an administrator. So that's very strange.
I thought Captain people. Underpants was a child.
No. It's one of the teachers.
Mr. Krupp.
Yeah, there you go. Or is it the principal? I can't remember. Somebody correct us, but it's one of the primary administrators.
So this is the thing, right? That may seem like a weird reason to ban a book or to ban a work of literature, but we have to realize that on any side of the ideological sphere, there are people who feel they have good reason to ban insert literature or insert book here. And the issue is not as cut and dried as it appears in the news sometimes, you know, because remember, mainstream news typically has about 4 to 7 minutes to tell you a thing and often doesn't hesitate to also imply how you should feel about that thing. But look, either way, doesn't matter. Book bans, inarguably, they're on the rise. I check out some work by the American Library Association. They note attempts to ban books are accelerating across the U.S. at a rate that is unprecedented. About 20 years ago, the ALA started saying, let's keep track of all these people trying to ban books. Let's just see what happens. And the rate is expanding exponentially. But in tonight's episode, we're asking a question. We already acknowledge, yes, people are trying to ban books. They are succeeding. Yes, people on both sides of the debate often accuse the other side of a conspiracy of some sort. But the big question is, should any books be banned? We'll pause for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's where it gets crazy.
Just before it gets crazy, guys, I just want to bring something up to your point, Ben, talking about news kind of having to or attempting to distill stuff down right into those quick sound bites. Did you guys see a headline come across your phones or at some point or computers in the past couple of weeks? I think it was this week that said three severed heads left at employee's desk in retaliation for something. That's what it said. That's like the whole headline was three severed heads left at desk after complaints, basically.
That one didn't hit my inbox.
Were they human heads?
They're human heads left at this employee's desk. What you find if you click on any of the links and take that bait, it's that it's a person who worked at a place that dealt with donor bodies, right? So it's not as though... It makes it, just leaving out all that information,
context
makes it feel
everything.
Like there's just somebody decapitated a couple of fellas and then left them on the, you know,
instead
desk.
Of like finding three heads from storage and saying, here you go. I hate you, Derek.
Yeah, I just murdered three people.
Chuck from Stuff You Should Know once terrorized me by leaving severed parrots, like these squishy, like stress ball parrots that we got from iHeart. radio mm-hmm. that everyone had. There were just dozens of them around the office. He like chopped their heads off and stabbed them with pencils and didn't tell me that it was him. And I was just felt like I was being menaced by some unseen stalker. And finally, I figured it out. But yeah, again, it could have just said, you know, severed parrot heads found on employee's desk without mentioning that they were styrofoam.
Dude, wow, you were being messed with. But the only reason I bring that up is just to land that concept as hard as we possibly can here before we keep going, that news outlets, when you're reading about these stories, they need your attention so badly. They are so desperate for you now to click on their thing mm-hmm. that it's going to be sensationalized no matter anybody's intentions, because it kind of has to be now
to compete.
Yeah. Well, you can also tell if you want to be a critical reader of things involving affairs of the state. One way you can always tell, and mentioned this in a previous episode, is through the use of verbs. The verbiage will tell you when something is meant to be slanted as an opinion piece. What do we mean by verbiage? It'll be something like so-and-so blast or so-and-so excoriates. Excoriates might be a little too fancy.
Obliterates.
Slams.
Recently, with this whole Cop City debate in Atlanta that I think most people, even not in Atlanta, are aware of, there was a public comment period or a couple, and the initial headline on the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was, "Protesters swarm state capitol." And the writer got a lot of flack for it because the idea of swarm implies some sort of invasion, like a negative, invasive force of chaos and disorder. And then they changed it to something like, you know, thousands turn up for public comment, you know, but like the initial one was going for exactly what we, and I know we're taking a little sidebar here, but I think it's very important and a really good point. But language is powerful, and a lot of these stories around language and how to control it are very slanted.
Yeah. And the shout out to everybody who went to the public debate or the public hearing regarding this. Was one of the longest in Atlanta's history. It went on until at least 5:30 in the morning. And despite near unanimous disapproval from the actual people of Atlanta, the Cop City movement is going forward. We are, of course, going to do an episode on this. In the meantime, do check out the work of Gare over on It Could Happen Here. Just some fantastic reporting, and that's out of Cool Zone Media, headed by our pal Robert Evans. Look, here's the thing. Let's frame the debate for ourselves. This is our here's where it gets crazy part. We'll take a page from the mainstream news, and we'll focus on the children. Whenever you want to get some government control into a political discourse, phrase it as protecting the children, right? We at the United Kingdom, we don't want to track your every movement on the internet as some sort of Orwellian control device. We're here to keep kids safe. And if you don't agree with our new surveillance rules for the internet, then you basically hate kids and you want them to be hurt. That's who you are. That's a very tricky thing, right? People don't want to hurt children. I would hope the majority of folks can agree with that. So if you want to pass something that ordinarily folks would never agree to, you phrase it as protecting vulnerable parts of the population. So the big question is, should books be banned from children's libraries? If we pro and con it, I think it's reasonable to say if you are a parent, you should have the right to decide what your kid can read and when. What is age appropriate? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Speak Up for Standards is a group seeking age-appropriate reading materials to be supplied to students in Dallas, Texas schools, and they had this to say about that exact concept. Literary works containing explicit scenes as well as vulgar and obscene language were on the approved reading list for grades 7 through 12, meaning that middle and grade school students might be exposed to inappropriate materials. This is, you know, I these kinds of organizations, I suppose they serve their purpose, but it does sort of take that agency away from the parents, which I think is an important distinction. You know, like parents are supposed to be the ones that decide what is and is not appropriate for their children, and they should be able to make that judgment based on the maturity of their kid. I think some 13-year-olds are totally cool with reading some of this more graphic and edgy stuff. Some may not be as mentally mature, you know, and that might not be good for them. It could actually send them down a negative path, or maybe they're troubled and have something that could potentially exacerbate, you know, some any kinds of psychological issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what about the flip side of that? The con argument would be, yes, you as a parent can control what your own children read, but does that give you a right to restrict what books are available to other people in the community at large? Like if you're saying, hey, guys, I think we should pull the Penthouse magazine collection from the middle school library. I think most people can agree that's a good move. But if you said, for instance, let's pull the Canterbury Tales or let's pull Ulysses from all libraries in our community, then are you not infringing upon the rights of adults in that community who, through taxation, pay the same amount that you do to keep the library running? Like, who gets to decide? That's the question.
Yeah, it gets so sticky here because, gosh, man, as a parent, you're sending your child to a facility that you are paying taxes on and sometimes paying money for them to go to, right? And you are paying money for school lunches and all the other kind of stuff. You're putting your child in someone else's control, right? And you're trusting that organization and group of people to do what you want, right? But it's a lot like our representative government in the United States, where you're putting your faith in that group of people that they're going to kind of represent you and what you want and wish as a parent. And when that doesn't line up on an individual level, I can imagine it being and feeling really uncomfortable, right? But it's not about the individual, unfortunately, in that situation, right? It's about laying out the curriculum for a child of that age range and a mind that's to be developed in that age range and at that level of social interaction and sophistication, right? And understanding. So I can understand why it's so weird.
Yeah. I mean, also, people who have a more moderate approach, I would say, to banning books, they'll do something that is a bit of a rhetorical straw man. They'll say, look, banning a book from a library is not the same as removing it entirely from publication, and no one is stopping an author from writing what they want, which, again, to your point, Noel, is a fundamental right here in the United States. But that avoids the main issue. That matrix dodges the main issue. It's not about the writing. It's about who has the right to access knowledge. And, you know, it is a sticky wicket. It's a tall milkshake. It's an entire bag of badgers. And no one really has the answers because everybody, again, can agree that you shouldn't try to poison the minds of children. We just, as a society, can't agree on what that poison might be. Right? It's an ideological conflict, and facts do not help in ideological conflicts.
No, they do not. Sorry. Sorry.
Sorry.
I love you. I love that you've got facts. Really do appreciate that. And I see your facts. I just don't think they are facts.
Where are your facts from? Those crazy commies over at the Bilderberg Foundation?
I will never hear Bilderberg Foundation and not think Build-A-Bear Foundation. It's just what pops into my head every time.
Guys, I've got a solution for the whole library thing. You don't ban books from a library. You make a special section in the library that's locked up, and you can only gain access if you have a long, drawn-out conversation with your child and librarian.
Sort of like that that back corner of the video store with the cameras pointed at it and the weird curtain, you know?
Yeah. Ben, you've got to talk about it for a long time.
What if we just build libraries in a hierarchy? You know what I mean? What if certain people can only go to certain libraries? You have a library for the poor, right? And they can't read anything about collective action. You have a library for the wealthy, and they can't read any, I don't know what they wouldn't read.
They kind of get it all, I think. They probably.
Yeah, I think at the top, that's blanche. Like, yeah, that's like your diamond medallion library.
Okay, last pitch. We don't ban books, we ban people.
Oh, okay? Interesting.
I'm going to leave it at that.
Well, that's the hierarchy. You know, you're progressively banning people.
Yeah, but well, I just mean like, in general. Let's just get rid of them.
Earth will be fine. That's humans are the problem for Earth. Anyway, Matt, what's on your mind, man?
Yeah, I could see it in my head. Your library book has an RFID chip in it, and there are different tiers of the library, like you're describing here, that you can get into. My library book only works for tiers 1 through 4, but if you can gain access to tier 7, that's where the good stuff is.
Well, it's like security clearances or something, you know? It's like access to classified documents. You know, you have to show that you are cleared to, because, I mean, that's dangerous information. I mean, you know, we're not talking about, that's not exactly what you'd consider books, but with this whole Trump classified documents scandal, you're starting to read some of the pages from the indictment. The types of documents that he had in his bathroom at Mar-a-Lago for just anyone going in there, you know, to have a little seat on the throne, find a little light reading material, seriously compromise national security, not in a hyperbolic way, like in a very real way.
Ooh. And we're going to get to that in just a second, too. And I like that direction, because what we need to do for the purposes of objectivity here, let's bracket the debate about children, which is sometimes held disingenuously, to be honest with you. Let's move on to the concept of dangerous books. Went on Twitter and said, hey, do you think any book should be banned? Don't worry about the kids' books or the ideological culture war debate. Are there dangerous books? Should they be banned? And one of the things that comes up pretty often is very successful racist propaganda, like Mein Kampf or the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And in the interest of full disclosure, just to be absolutely fair, we have read copies of both of these works, and they're not well written. They're not even well written books.
I just want to say, when Ben says we, I am excluded from that week because I've not read Mein Kampf, but okay. I can't wait to. No, I'm just joking.
Let me save you some time. Not worth it. And my rationale personally for reading books that I know I will object to is that I feel it is, if you disagree with something, it is your intellectual responsibility to understand it as much, if not more, than the people who believe in it. Right. So.
Well, I guess I need to get on that.
Dude, you saved so much time. It is not a good book. No one should read it. It's dumb. And it led to horrific things. It would also definitely be a red flag for any country if those books became super popular. You know what I mean? That would be a bad sign.
Wait, didn't it become really popular not that long ago again?
Oh, man. I think you're right. In Germany, right?
Yep. I'm seeing a Reuters article from 2017. Quote, reprint of Hitler's Mein Kampf takes Germany by storm. Apparently sales have soared at this time since a special edition of this book went on sale in Germany in 2016.
Yeah, it spent 35 weeks in 2016 on the nonfiction bestseller list in Germany. Sold 85,000 copies.
Germany has intense laws surrounding Nazi memorabilia, Nazi speech, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, it is like highly illegal to possess Nazi artifacts. And I think, you know, you can really get in big trouble for espousing any kind of hate speech.
Yeah, I've got some friends, U.S. nationals who are living working and moving through Germany currently and have been for a few years. And it's very true. It's not something where you want to be a little internet edgelord and say, no, what about blah, blah, blah? Not funny. And those laws do exist for a reason. It's tricky, though, because when you attempt to suppress a work, you inevitably encounter the Streisand effect in modern civilization. You increase its visibility. That means people who might be vulnerable to racist propaganda, who would have ordinarily not picked up this book, they are going to be more likely to read it, even if they would have ignored it. Noel, off air, we were talking about this a little bit, and you raised the comparison of Prohibition.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, similar to the Streisand effect, the idea if you want something gone, it's just going to proliferate that thing even more. With Prohibition, you know, you make something illegal that people like, they're just going to find other ways to get it. And then chances are it'll balloon out of your control, much more than if you had just left it alone in the first place and like regulated it and kept an eye on it, because then, you know, things kind of move to the shadows and start to take on kind of a whole nother life of its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me of the Cobra effect.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Cobra effect. Look it up. It's important for you to know that that's a real thing.
So, that is dangerous ideological stuff, right? Those are books arguing that a sizable portion of humanity is somehow inherently bad, and that results in the death of innocent people. Inarguable. It does. Those are bad books. But what about books that contain potentially dangerous secular knowledge? Real step-by-step guides to doing things like creating improvised explosive devices, or hypothetically, I don't know too much about this one. What if there was a manual, IKEA style, that taught you how to build nuclear warheads?
Yeah. What if?
I think that one would be tens of thousands of times less dangerous than a book that showed you how to make, you know, an explosive device out of manure and fertilizer and that kind of stuff. Right. Just because you couldn't get your hands on, you know, anything to get fissile material, but you can sure as heck go down and buy some fertilizer.
It's a good point. Yeah. I mean, a quote unquote manual for, say, or a schematic for like a nuclear power plant, you know, is that, would that make it easier to, say, carry out a terrorist attack on said plant, to know how the infrastructure works and the ins and outs? I don't know if that stuff is kept completely confidential, but I think you can get your hands on some material like that.
You can. I think the point you're getting at here, Matt, is an instruction manual that requires, it's like a recipe, right? An instruction manual recipe that requires very hard to obtain ingredients is going to be less of a threat, because someone might really want to build a nuclear bomb, but they can't even get a hold of a decent centrifuge, right?
Yeah.
So that's way different from realizing, oh, I can take and beep me here, Paul, and then mix them at a certain temperature to create an explosive that I can put in the kind of pipe you would buy at Home Depot, right?
Yes. That's why a simple children's chemistry book called The Golden Book of Chemistry Experiments was banned in, I think it was like 1970, 1969. And it was a children's book for chemical experiments that you could do for fun at home with your family. But in there, you might figure out how to make chlorine gas, or might figure, actually not might, you would figure out how to make some really dangerous things.
But then where does the line stop? You know, a good textbook for becoming an electrician can teach you how to wire things in dangerous ways. And it can also contain information that if attempted by a novice could endanger the life of the novice, or certainly give him a zap, make life a little more exciting for a few seconds. I don't know. Like, how would you? Here's the thing. There's no getting around it. In the wrong hands, those books can lead directly to the loss of human life. But how do you address that? Do we try to create a registry for books? Only the military can buy them. You can only get them if you're in an approved academic institution. And then how do you keep track of all the opportunities to make copies? How do you keep an eye on every version of the book, man? Because college students are broke and regularly sell books back at the end of the semester for peanuts.
No, very complicated questions there. I don't know how you even make those decisions. Like, what is your rubric? How dangerous is this for society as a whole? Does it better society having the anarchist cookbook around and available just in case we need it? Or is it better that we just don't have that knowledge? And then how in the heck do you control it?
Well, I mean, it's sort of like the gun control debate, you know, it's the idea that some people say that guns don't kill people. People kill people. You know, books don't kill people. People learn how to kill people by reading books. And sure haven't been very successful with gun control. So I don't see how this is any more or less dangerous. Seems like kind of a moot point when you have actual weapons of murder, you know, readily available to just about anybody with a driver's license.
It seems like a losing proposition then from that perspective. Yeah. I mean, I love that we're mentioning the anarchist cookbook. I have several versions of that book from back in the day. It is the height of an unreliable narrator because some stuff is put in a couple of versions there as pranks, but you can easily find this as a PDF, and it's a reference work. It's a bootleg collection of all sorts of interesting projects from old school telephone hacking all the way up to here's how you build a bomb. Here's how you can concentrate nicotine from tobacco products into an actual poison. Here is how you can make LSD at home, just like Owsley, but not as good as Owsley's LSD, probably. Should there be a law preventing people from writing these sorts of manuals? I mean, does that go to fiction, right? We talked about that book Stephen King removed from publication of his own accord.
Rage.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah. He removed Rage because he was concerned that Rage describes a school shooting that was planned in advance, premeditated, and King was worried that his instructions, his depictions, were close enough to how you would actually do this successfully that it would function as an instruction manual.
It's also apparently not very good.
It's not. It's not my favorite.
I think that was part. I mean, I appreciate the benevolence there, Mr. King, but I did also get a sense that he was embarrassed by it just as a work because it was like when he wrote it when he was like still really young. I think he wrote it when he was like a teenager, maybe.
Well, it was 1977, right? And
it came out.
And he wrote it as Richard Bachman.
As the Bachman days. That was his, and probably still is, his alias for a while for some darker works. But he was also, from what I understand, he was incredibly disturbed, and rightly so, because multiple school shootings in the 80s and early 90s, when they occurred, authorities later found a copy of Rage amid the belongings of the perpetrators. So it is a real problem. But, you know, even if the author themselves tries to put the monsters back in Pandora's jar, it's usually too late, right? Like, this guy wrote the book, doesn't want it out there, and people still have copies. In fact, they became collector's editions because there are no new editions out there.
Speaking of collector's editions, the book Stuff They Don't Want You to Know has been banned, and you cannot get it anywhere. But, and don't read it. Definitely don't read it. But we need to take a break so you can go do something else for a few moments while you listen to some ads. So don't buy the banned book, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, in this ad break.
Available everywhere books are sold.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
She's breathing right now? Yes, she's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned. Let's set up the point, or let's pursue the point, Noel, that you set up so well just a few minutes ago. This idea of banning stuff can apply to confidential or classified government info. I mean, forget books about trans youth. Forget the idea of For the Children. This one part of the debate is where Uncle Sam does not play around. Even the most extreme advocates of openness and transparency, the kind of people who fight for FOIA reform, they're going to agree that some of that stuff has to stay under wraps because it's national security. And as you mentioned earlier, while we are recording today, this is one of the big issues facing a former president of the U.S. How is it going to go? We don't know. I imagine this will drag out in court for a little while, right?
Yeah, while there's a presidential election campaign going on.
Oh, right, that too.
And somehow no one is that worried that it's going to have any effect on his prospects.
Well, yeah, again, and I think people are pointing this out more and more often now. There are only two requirements to be the president of the United States of America. You just have to be born in the U.S. and you have to be, what is it 35?
Yeah.
Or 87, whatever. Any, it doesn't matter.
You have to be at least 35. You have to be from the U.S. Anything else goes. Isn't that nuts?
And yet they disenfranchise people convicted of a felony.
Right.
Right.
But if you want to run for president, that's totally cool. You just can't vote for president.
I kind of love it. How I love picturing the pitch meetings of the founding fathers. You know, people also tended to die earlier. People also, and they're saying, okay, 35. By 35, you know what's going on, right? And you can't be British, but we don't want to say that part.
Well, it's just another example of how everything's kind of built on this gentleman's agreement, you know, that like, we don't need a bunch of rules. No felon is going to run for president. And if they did, they'd never get anywhere because people would, you know, be like shocked.
Yeah.
Things have changed.
I like to picture this idea just totally wrecking the life and the day of some guy who's like 34 years old and was to go head to head with George Washington. And he's going, conspiracy?
Yes.
I'll be back next year. And they're like, no, good point. Let's see how long George can be president because, Darren, you are unhinged, my friend. So the thing is, like, we see these cases of self-selecting suppression of a book. You know, an example would be the Crew Change Guide, which we talked about before. People who function as, you could call them modern day nomads or hobos or whatever, train hoppers, folks who ride the rails illegally, they have a book. And this book is called the Crew Change Guide. You are not supposed to sell it nor to publish it. There are a couple of academic institutions which have outdated versions of these. Instead, the idea is you pass it on in person. You hand it to a fellow traveler when they've sort of proven that they are trustworthy. And through this process, the train hopping community banned the book effectively from the majority of the reading public.
That's so weird to me.
You like it or you don't like it?
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it.
I mean, they're banning a book.
Yeah, they are banning a book, but just... I want to know how to hop trains, but I'm never going to hop a train. But if I need to, I want to know how to hop a train. Give me that book.
Just go on YouTube. Read books.
I mean, and then another example of self-banning or suppression would be Scientology, right? You find this in the world of religion and spirituality. There are sacred texts which are banned from the public. And we didn't find out, or we knew about the non-public Scientology writing, which they call technology, but we hadn't read it, I think, personally until it was published via WikiLeaks. Yeah, and Scientology
is all the Xenu stuff, the end of the bridge or whatever, and it's, you know, the stuff that really kind of, frankly, made Scientology a bit of a laughingstock, and a lot of the folks that had paid their way up to that point were like, "Wait, what? It's what? Alien ghosts? I'm sorry,
yeah,
interdimensional overlord? Okay."
And they say, "Well, we did record what you said during your audit sessions."
Sunk cost fallacy, right? At that just point, so. You're sort of like, "Ooh, maybe I'm gonna go find another religion to mess with."
Guys, I was at the antique store the other day, and I found a full collection of what's the cat's name?
L. Ron
Hubbard's old science fiction writing, and it was so great. They're like pulp fiction novels, you know, like just. Oh, it was so.
He got
many
paid
of them
by the word in those days. Apparently, he would like write. He would type it on rolls of paper, and like he would just, like literally just churning these things out. He submitted them all to magazines, and you know, by and large, was considered. I guess that's where hack comes from. Is literally someone who's hacking away at the typewriter because they get paid by the word. I mean, I'm just guessing, but that was him. And then this writing stuff for the birds. Maybe I'll become a god.
Oh, Scientology. Oh, L. Ron, the Commodore himself, probably had some things to say about banning books. But, you know, look, you can hear other episodes we've done on Scientology, and you can encounter other peer podcasts of ours who examine the controversy surrounding the COS or Church of Scientology. But they openly acknowledge that they as an organization hold some material back from public access, and they have a quote about it. This comes directly from their website. We're not spinning it. We're not giving you an editorial. This is what they have said.
The vast majority of Scientology scriptures are widely available to the general public and can be read and studied by anyone. However, a very small portion of the scriptures that deal with the most advanced levels of spiritual counseling is restricted to those parishioners who have attained the prior levels of spiritual awareness.
Okay. So it's like a class with prereqs. Like in university, they're basically saying, they say you want to be prepared or to read this and understand it and not have damaging effects. You have to be prepared to receive these materials. They have another quote where they say premature exposure could impede your spiritual development. So again, we see this concept of protecting people. We are restricting your access to information for your own good. And there's the rub, as Shakespeare would say. I mean, the amount of, or the idea of protecting people is a tall milkshake. How can you be, how can you agree to be protected from something if you're not allowed to know what you're being protected from?
Oh, it reminds me of that movie Demolition Man.
Oh,
what are the seashells?
Three seashells.
That's always the part that
clearly
I remember.
Clearly, that's
that
the
movie.
Part that yeah. that two thirds of us remember.
Yeah. Yeah. No, just like
something to do with going to the bathroom.
Oh, and VR sex is very big.
Well, just the concept that society has gotten to a place where all of these concepts no longer even exist because all of it has been banned to the point where in every room in your society, there's a little microphone. And if you say a swear word or something inappropriate, you get fined a few cents or whatever, because it's so they're suppressing any thought that could be out there.
Oh, I mean, kids always remember throughout history, like any time there is a need to keep tabs on people or to ban information, that is a real to-do. It's very difficult to do it successfully. Like if you look at like East and West Berlin and like this German secret police and stuff, having like kids like narking on their parents and all that. Like if you've ever seen the movie The Lives of Others, like that is a real organizational conundrum just to get that done, to keep it up. And it honestly kind of wrecks society and makes it worse than if you just let the information be out there and have people decide for themselves.
And, you know, that's a big part of the question, right? Who should be the arbiter here? Who watches the watchman? Who decides what knowledge is or is not appropriate? I mean, if we're being reasonable, if we just trace the logic out, it runs into doublethink really quickly. Because if you are the person or the entity who decides what books should be banned, that means you have to have knowledge of what you're banning, which means you have to violate your own ban by reading the thing.
I figured it out. We'll just let Mrs. Davis do it. We'll let the algorithm, the AI.
Oh, great. Yeah, the AI would be great. And then we can't read things like iRobot. And then we can't read things, you know, like the script for Space Odyssey 2001 or 2001 A Space Odyssey. I mean, the problem right now for banning books, I think it's in the U.S. currently, it's more hinging on the ideological conflict. The people who want to ban books in libraries, they're not worried about somebody learning how to make a bomb. They're not worried about people illegally modifying firearms, figuring out how to rob an ATM, etc. They're worried an ideology in conflict with their own will be transmitted to someone else, and that the audience for that conflicting ideology might agree with it. So like, if you're removing these opportunities to encounter other beliefs that you may not agree with, then are we not also inherently removing an individual's right to choose what they believe? Like if you go into a restaurant, if every restaurant you have ever gone to only has pinto beans on the menu and you don't know that other restaurants serve other stuff, then like what is your opinion on restaurants? Does your opinion matter? You only know about the bean restaurants. Sit down. Sorry, maybe that doesn't land, but
all beans taste the same.
Sit down and enjoy your pintos because they are delicious here.
Mm-hmm. He really, I feel like beans are like fruity pebbles. You know, each they're different colors, but they're all the same flavor.
What?
All right, that's my hot take, and I will die on this bean hill.
Oh,
this
hill of beans. God.
There we go, hill of beans. I love it. So maybe we end with a thought experiment just to drive this home. What if you? This is better than the bean restaurant example. What if you grew up in a world where, for some reason, all books about the moon were banned? Every book, every work of literature referring to the moon, every textbook talking about the moon and gravity and the effect of tides, all the poems, all the crappy poems that say stuff about the moon, it was all removed. No one talks about it in the public, but the moon is still up there, right? You see it on a consistent basis. No one can write about it. How long does that society function with that weird idiosyncrasy?
Well, you would just name it something else, and now it's that. Now you can talk about that.
The Noom. Yeah.
There you go. Good night, Noom. One of the greatest books ever written.
So, I mean, that's the thing, right? How is that argument different from what we're talking about? Like, if you want literature to ignore stuff in the real world, literature reflects, responds to the world outside of books, right? So you can change the past or the depiction of it. You can change the way it's written about. You can suppress conversations about topics you personally don't like, but the real world is still there. And those topics, if they are real, still exist. I mean, banning books, I don't know. It might be right for some people, but it's not going to make those things we object to suddenly disappear.
Nope. Not unless we let the AI, you know, eradicate all thought that is outside of the AI's parameters for humanity.
There we go. Tiered libraries. I don't know. Maybe we end it this way. Should books be banned? Should any books be banned?
Yes. All of them.
All of them. We're done with reading. Literature should be
banned. I'm being a jerk, but I will say it. Part of this does feel a little moot in our digital age, where it's literally impossible to remove things from the internet. You know what I mean? It's just like, to your point about the Streisand effect, like, it's just a phenomenon. The internet has a life of its own. It is a self-replicating system. And not to mention things like the dark web, you know, where we know that that's its own. It's not as safe or as private as you might think. But nah, I don't think it's possible to. Well, we do know the whole country censor parts of the internet, you know, and that is a thing that can be done. But no, I don't think books should be banned. I don't. I think maybe there's cases where access should be limited, just like with the, you know, is it going to cause harm directly?
When you guys travel to other countries, do you ever try and look up things in that other country that you think might be suppressed within the U.S., like within the infrastructure of the U.S. networks?
100%.
Have you ever found anything?
In my opinion, yes.
Wow.
But
so I don't think I've traveled enough to even like attempt it yet, but that's a fascinating concept, that just that we are all in some kind of information ban, right?
Mm-hmm. Info bubbles all day.
And we
day.
Don't know it.
No. We're the folks in Plato's cave, right? So often. But this is where we want to pass the library card to you folks while those are still a thing. What do you think? You know, for being intellectually honest, should any books be banned? Should access be a free-for-all? Should some things be limited? Is it even possible nowadays to do so? Let us know. For now, you can find us all sorts of places online, we hope, even after this episode publishes.
That's right. You can find us all over the internet until we're removed from it. Hopefully not anytime soon. We exist at the handle Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram and TikTok.
Do you like phones and use in your mouth? Well, call 1-833-STDWYDK. That didn't really work out, guys, but that is the phone number. When you call in, you've got 3 minutes. Please give yourself a cool nickname and say whatever you'd like. Just at some point, let us know if we can use your name and message on the air. If you've got more to say that can fit in that 3-minute voice message about how you just bought our book for all your friends and family, then why not instead send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.